Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, on Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Paul Saffo. I teach at Stanford and am Managing Director of Discern Analytics here in San Francisco. I'll be your moderator for today's program. My pleasure to introduce our very special guest this evening, Jeremy Rifkin. Jeremy is an economic and social theorist, best-selling author, public speaker, policy advisor, and activist. He is president of the Foundation of Economic Trends and an advisor to the European Union and to heads of state around the world. He's also a senior lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania. Most importantly, Jeremy is an intellectual agent provocateur with a talent for forcing policymakers and others to seriously consider the implications of overlooked large-scale shifts hovering just over the horizon. And in this regard, just consider the following very small sampling of the titles of his 20-plus books published over the years. In 1977, shortly after the idea of recombinant DNA was proposed, and decades ahead of the decoding of the human genome, he wrote the book titled, Who Should Play God? The Artificial Creation of Life and What It Means for the Future of Humanity. In 1992, a decade before kale became cool and ketchup was still considered a vegetable, he wrote Beyond Beef, The Rise and Fall of Cattle Culture. And in 2000, half a decade ahead of Facebook, before the rise of social media, the appearance of Silicon Valley zillionaires and their buses, and in the very depths of the dot-com bust, he wrote The Age of Access, The New Culture of Hypercapitalism. He is someone with a knack of identifying things over the horizon that everyone else seems to miss, but somehow end up in our lives sooner than expected. Tonight, we're delighted he has come here to talk about his new book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism, in which he explores a confluence of technology from the Internet to ubiquitous sensors and 3D printing, and how that confluence is atom-smashing traditional notion of capitalisms and markets and leading us into a new economic era defined by an emergent collaborative commons. Please join me in welcoming Jeremy Rifkin to the stage.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. We are just beginning to glimpse the bare outlines of a new economic system entering onto the world stage. It's called the Collaborative Commons. This is the first new economic paradigm since the onset of capitalism and its antagonist socialism in the early 19th century. It's a remarkable historic event, and it has long-term implications for all of us in our day-to-day lives. The trigger that's precipitating this new economic system in our midst is something called zero marginal cost. Don't be frightened. It's something we use in business schools and in the business community. Marginal cost is the cost of producing an additional unit of a good or service once the fixed costs have been absorbed. Let me explain that there's a paradox deeply embedded in the heart of the capitalist system that's previously being undisclosed. You know, Karl Marx spent a lifetime and a lot of writing trying to disclose the innards of how capitalism operates, but he was quite obsessed with the means of production surplus labor. There's a deeper paradox that goes to the heart of the system. And that is, in a capitalist market, sellers are always trying to find new technologies that can increase their productivity, reduce their marginal cost, so they can put out cheaper products, and as a result, win over more consumers and bring some nice profits back to their investors. Every business wants to reduce their marginal cost. It's good business. It's just that economists and business people never anticipated the possibility of a technology revolution whose productivity was so extreme that it could take those marginal costs of producing goods and services to near zero, making each additional unit basically priceless, almost free, abundant, and beyond market exchange. This has been going on for now over 15 years. The zero marginal cost phenomenon, we first saw its devastating impact in the information goods sector with the rise of Napster, this little music service back in 1999. Apparently, the young kids had nothing else to do after school but figure out new software to connect with each other and share their music, bypassing royalties to the recording companies. We called it cheating. They called it sharing. That's the beginning of the paradigm shift. Then the zero marginal cost, it just devastated the recording industry. It never came back. The zero marginal cost phenomenon then began to invade the newspapers, magazine, and book publishing. Millions of consumers turned prosumers, and they began to produce their own information, video, audio, and text. They began to share knowledge on places like Wikipedia. They began to create their own news blogs, their own information across the board, bypassing the capitalist market altogether, sharing it with each other. The zero marginal cost phenomena devastated the magazine and newspaper industry. The magazines bellied up quickly, went out of business. Newspapers folded all over the world. Some of them are now blogs. And I can tell you in book publishing, I've been in book publishing for over 45 years, e-books, and especially free e-books and copyleft for e-books, have devastated the publishing industry. Now, for quite a while, industry observers said, well, you know what, this is a good thing, because the more we head to near zero marginal cost and we can produce and share free information goods with each other, this opens up the opportunity for the capitalist free enterprise system to take advantage of these freemiums, then to create new services for premiums. So the long tail. The long tail turns out to be a myth. I'll give you an example of the long tail. Musicians will give away their music, and they will hope that that will entice a certain amount of their loyal followers to go and pay for the paid concerts from freemium to premium. Or, as you know, the New York Times will give you 10 little articles a month free, hoping the premium will seduce you to subscribe to the premium service. The problem is, as we've now looked at it 10 years later, it just didn't happen on any significant scale. Because when more and more information goods are nearly free, and there's so much out there in the system and so little time to absorb it, there's very little need to go to the premium services. And so information goods have really devastated everything from the recording industry, newspapers, magazines, book publishing, across the board. Economists, however, while a little concerned, said, we think there's a firewall here. And that even though information goods can move to near zero marginal cost in virtual space, there's a firewall, and that zero marginal cost effect will not cross that firewall into the physical world, the brick and mortar world of energy and manufactured products. No longer. There is a new technology revolution emerging in the last really 24 months, and it's a game changer. And it's going to allow us to go from bits to atoms, and allow us to begin to reduce the marginal cost to near zero across wide sectors of the physical world. The Internet of Things. The communication internet, we all know, is just now beginning to converge with a fledgling energy internet in Europe. and a nascent transport and logistics internet. It's just beginning in the last 24 months. What we're beginning to see is an expansive internet. This internet of things is three internets in one. Let me explain that throughout history, when we look at every society, societies require three different phenomena to merge and come together to create a platform for people to actually exchange social and economic life. You need a form of communication, a form of power, and a form of mobility. For example, in the 19th century, the first industrial revolution, the communication was steam power printing. It could reduce the transaction costs and put out a lot of cheap printed material, and the telegraph. The power source was coal and steam power engine. The mobility was the locomotive, which allowed us then to bring people together across nations, create national markets in dense urban cities. 20th century, second industrial revolution, the communication vehicle was centralized electricity, especially the telephone, later radio and television. The power source for society was oil, and mobility was the internal combustion engine. Now we're entering a third industrial revolution. It's our formal plan in Europe. I was privileged to help develop this plan for the European Union. And we see these three things coming together in a new way. Communication, the communication internet. Energy, renewable energy, and a distributed energy internet. And mobility, automated transport and logistics in one operational system. And now this system of three internets that's emerging is putting out sensors across the economic value chain, connecting everything, with every human being in one neural network. Think of it as a distributed brain. We've got 14 billion sensors out there already connecting resource flows. We have sensors on factory production lines monitoring the production. We have sensors in warehouses, in distribution centers, and on smart roads watching the traffic flows. We've got sensors on the electricity grid, so we know the price of electricity moment to moment. We've got sensors now connecting your appliances, so you know when to use them and when not to use them. We have sensors connecting offices and homes and now vehicles. And they're continually feeding back data to these three internets that are emerging in an operating system. It is like an intelligent neural network. In 2020, Cisco says we'll be up to 50 billion sensors. And you ready? 2030, the projection now is 100 trillion sensors. Yeah. Now, when I said that, you both were excited and frightened at the same time, right? Because on one side, we have the opportunity now to connect the human race and the entire biosphere of this planet in one neural network and begin to act as a single extended human family, with the mission of learning how to live with our fellow creatures on one planet in which we are all connected. On the other hand, it raises terrifying questions about data security, personal privacy, and whether this system could be abused and misused for cyber terrorism. We'll get into all of that a little bit later. Already, this Internet of Things has allowed us to move through the firewall, and we are now producing green energy at near zero marginal cost, and we've just begun producing 3D printed products, and it's moving toward near zero marginal cost. Renewable energy. In Europe, we now have millions and millions of small players, homeowners, small businesses, neighborhoods, that have created cooperatives, electricity cooperatives, just like we did with our rural electric cooperatives back in this country in the 1940s. And they have installed solar and wind across much of Europe. I advise Chancellor Merkel and have since she came into office. And in Germany, we're producing 25% of our electricity is now solar and wind. That's amazing. We're heading to 35% green electricity by 2020, way ahead of the rest of the world. We've converted 1 million buildings. They're now producing power with solar panels and wind turbines and geothermal heat pumps, and we've just begun. The price of these harvesting technologies are still a little pricey, but they're following an evolution, a curve that's exponential, just like computer chips. With computer chips, you remember in the 1950s, what was it? Watson, the chairman of IBM, said, we'll probably need about four computers. Kind of underestimated that because they were so expensive. They cost millions. We didn't see the Intel chip coming. That computer chip allowed us to move on an exponential curve where we doubled the knowledge, half the cost every 2 years, and now you get a cheap cell phone and a desktop computer. We've got 40% of the human race. We did this in 24 years. 40% of the human race now equipped with a cell phone and a cheap computer are actually producing and sharing information goods, video, audio, text, blogs, everything, at near zero marginal cost. This isn't academic. It's already passed through the information goods industry. Now with renewable energy, the harvesting technology is really getting cheap. One solar watt in 1978 cost $60. It's 66 cents a watt today, and it's going to head down to near zero. But even when you put in these harvesting technologies for solar and wind, payback somewhere between 3 and 9 years. But the moment you put that technology in, the marginal cost of generating your solar and wind electricity is near zero. The sun off the roof of your home is free. The wind flowing up across your sidewall of your building is free. The geothermal heat seeping up from the ground is free. So we now have millions of people in Europe who are actually producing energy at near zero marginal cost, and it's taken down the utility companies. Some of you, if you know Germany, you know they have the most powerful utility companies in the world, EnBW and E.ON. And guess what? They've experienced the same shutdown as the recording industry in less than 6 years. Just last week, one of the board of directors at E.ON, one of these great global companies, says, we're out of the power business. We can't compete with near zero marginal cost. When millions of small players come together and just put little bits of green electricity together, it overwhelms the vertical integration we had with the old power system. So we're now in the business at E.ON of moving toward service solutions and helping manage the networks. That's amazing. Now 3D printing. We have several hundred thousand hobbyists. We have small and medium-sized enterprises and startup companies. They're doing 3D printing. Just a short summary. With a 3D printer, you can print out a physical product, just like a regular printer for software. So you have a 3D printer, and you can be in Senegal or in Palo Alto, and you can download from the communication internet the free software to print out the product. Then you can use recycled plastic, junk plastic, recycled, melt it down, and now recycled paper, and melt it down at very low marginal cost. Then the software instructs this molten material to layer by layer build up a one-dimensional whole physical product with moving parts, pops out of the printer. This is additive manufacturing, so it uses one-tenth of the material of traditional centralized factories. In a centralized factory, you cut up the material, throw a lot of it out, make the finished product. It's like French cooking, totally wasteful, beautiful product at the end of the line. So here with additive manufacturing, the software is building up the product, one-tenth the materials. Then you connect to the Internet of Things, which is just emerging, and you power your local factory, you can in Germany, with green electricity from an energy internet from the local microgrids at near zero marginal cost electricity. Then you can market your 3D printed product on global websites like Etsy. I love the young folks at Etsy. 7 years now, and they've got 900,000 small businesses on the site all over the world advertising for free. 60 million consumers going on the site looking for the small business to connect up. And the only fee, when you make a deal, the seller and the buyer, Etsy gets a tiny commission. And then on the Internet of Things, you can start to connect up to the fledgling transport and logistics grid and send your 3D printed product to market in an electric vehicle, powered by your own green electricity from your energy internet at near zero marginal cost. In 3 years from now, you'll power it with fuel cell vehicles. All six major auto companies will be in production in 2016, hydrogen cars, trucks, and buses. And then you have GPS guidance. And eventually the GPS is already beginning to tell you where the parking spaces, where are the fueling stations. And within 5 to 10 years, we will have driverless vehicles on those transport lanes automated at low marginal cost. This is a game changer. This is a disruptive economic revolution on the same scale as capitalism and socialism in the early 19th century. So here's the question. If hundreds of millions of people and maybe billions of people can produce and share their own goods and services at near zero marginal cost, what kind of economic system would we have to devise to manage that kind of economy where profits are no longer the issue and where we have abundance and not scarcity? This Internet of Things is interesting because what it allows us to do, it allows millions of prosumers to connect into the system and then have that big data flow come right to you. And you can take your little mobile and an app that can be created for you, and you can take that big data anywhere in the economic system as an individual, and you can use analytics and create your own algorithms just like Google and Facebook, because the apps will let you do it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. This will allow you to increase your efficiencies, dramatically increase productivity, reduce the marginal cost for you to create your own information goods, energy, and physical goods. It's just beginning. It's not quite here. But we now have a trend line. There's enough out there in the system with near zero marginal cost energy and 3D printer products. We see where it's heading. So if I had said to you in 1989, a year before the World Wide Web came online, that in 24 years, 40% of the human race would be communicating with each other near zero marginal cost, that they'd be able to go up to on Google and in 3 seconds have access to the knowledge of the world, or that 1 out of 6 people would be on Facebook in the biggest human family album in history, or that 650 million people would be tweeting about their bowel movements and whether they're at the grocery store or whatever else is of interest to them during the day, and they'd be doing it at near zero marginal cost and wipe out the information goods industry in 20 years, what would you have said? Utopia fantasy. Now that we go from bits to atoms, that next 20 years on the Internet of Things is going to allow us to do it with energy and a lot, but not all, manufactured products. Let me say that the wild card here is food and water, because that's a different ilk. And as I say in the book, in the Zero Marginal Cost Society, that wild card could derail everything because of climate change. And I don't have to tell you in California, with the drought you're experiencing year after year after year, we're now asking, can we maintain a population on the western part of this country with no water? And what about the food basket for the world, which is California? So we'll get to the wild card maybe in the Q&A. So what kind of a system would we need to organize a world where we can produce and share our goods and services together? Well, economists say, you know, there's only 2 ways to organize the economy, either the government or private enterprise, or some combination of both. You either have capitalism, socialism, or in Europe, we have a social market economy. The economists forget there's another institution in our daily life all over the world that provides all sorts of goods and services that are absolutely essential to our flourishing on this planet. And it's not private enterprise, and it's not government. It's the social commons. Some of it's formalized in terms of nonprofit organizations, but we have cooperatives and all sorts of other organizations that have nothing to do with profit, and they help build our social capital. They create our communities, our shared meanings. It could be a healthcare center, nonprofit. It could be a cooperative producing electricity in a rural part of the United States. You know that most of our food comes from cooperatives. In most of the world, the banking systems are cooperatives. The housing is cooperative, including here in the U.S. And we say, well, how could you manage a system without profit? Wake up call. We have literally billions of people, and all of us in this room, in one part of our life or another, are using co-ops. From the food you buy in the store, from farm co-ops, to the credit unions that you engage in. So the social commons is a huge sector, but the economists don't pay attention to it because it's not profit-directed. It's directed to social capital. But in terms of revenue, $2.2 trillion in revenue of the 40 countries recently surveyed. And here's the interesting part of it. The social commons in between 2000 and 2010 has been growing much faster than the private enterprise market. The social commons has grown, revenue has grown at 42% from 2000 to 2010. The GDP in the private enterprise system has grown by 16%, and that trend line's not changing. Interesting. But what makes this a new ball game is the social commons is now coming out of the shadow to be potentially the the sector in which we can lodge the Internet of Things and move a collaborative commons. And the reason is this Internet of Things, it's kind of like the technological soulmate of a social commons. The whole purpose of this expanded Internet of Things is to be distributed, collaborative, and to allow millions and millions of people to come together, eliminate the middleman, and directly engage each other in making and sharing things together and creating communities. That's its purpose. Now, we'll talk later about this conflict that's emerging on who's going to control this expanded Internet of Things. And certainly there's a lot of old interest that would like to control the system. But I think in the final analysis, near zero marginal cost, it's just too sweet. And once the technology's out there, we will use it. The recording industry could not stop the young people sharing music. And the newspapers and magazines, as powerful as they were crippled by millions of us engaging directly with each other to share our information. I suspect it's going to be a big conflict, but in the end, I suspect we will head there. Let me say, I don't think capitalism is going to disappear. I think there will be goods and services that are going to have a sufficient margin that's going to require a capitalist market for exchange. I suspect that by 2050, most of our efforts will be in the collaborative commons, and the capitalist market will be a very savvy, sophisticated, powerful niche player, primarily using technical skills to aggregate network solutions and services, because that requires a huge amount of technical skills. We're already seeing a hybrid economy, part capitalist market, part collaborative commons. Sometimes they benefit each other, sometimes they're adversarial. You saw Airbnb this week, and here in the San Francisco paper, the front page today was providing parking spaces for sharing cars. And now you're having a debate about Airbnb, and Airbnb is a classic example of the near zero marginal cost moving over to the brick and mortar world. The marginal cost of Airbnb to keep their operation going is literally the web, the Internet. Very little marginal cost. And millions of apartment dwellers and homeowners, they've already got their fixed costs covered because they're paying their mortgage, they're paying their property taxes. So the marginal cost of renting out their rooms is near zero. And that's why Airbnb, and I particularly like couch surfing because it's all free, millions of people are sharing their homes, sharing their couches at near zero marginal cost. And in the case of Airbnb, it's now bigger than the biggest hotel chains. And they're going to be valued at probably $10 billion by the end of the week. But now we're not only sharing information goods and now energy in Europe, at least at zero, near zero marginal cost, and just beginning to share our manufactured products, info-factured products, 3D products at near zero marginal cost. We're sharing the cars with car sharing services here in San Francisco and around the world. We're sharing our homes and apartments on Airbnb and couch surfing. We're sharing our clothes with ThredUp. We're sharing our tools and toys on a collaborative commons, some of it bypassing the capitalist market. None of this is figured in GDP. Because if you share, you know, GDP is just a measure of all the stuff we produce, even if it's negative to the quality of life. The more prisons, the more GDP. The more pollution you have to clean up, the more GDP. The more military arms, the more the GDP. So what's happening here, though, as we move to this collaborative commons, for every car we share, it takes 9 or 10 cars off the road. That means less purchases. It means more people use less resources to get more mobility. Same with bike sharing and clothes. It used to be you buy clothes and you wear them for a month or two and that's it. Now you can recycle them over and over and over. It's not in the GDP, but you're buying less clothes in the stores, but you're using resources more efficiently by using less and more people sharing it. It's the millennial kids that are bringing us into a sustainable society. They prefer access over ownership. They're not wedded to the idea of possessions. They're wedded to the idea of sustainability. And it's actually succeeding on a pretty significant scale. So, where does this put us? I think the major issue here, there's many issues, but one we have to confront is the future of employment. Because what we're seeing here with this introduction of an Internet of Things, an expanded Internet, and a shift to the collaborative commons is we're redefining what it means to be a productive person in society. If millions of people are prosumers, not just consumers, the whole idea of sellers and buyers and owners and workers breaks down. Because now millions of us are both the owners and the consumers and the sharers of what we make. So that means we might need less income if we can produce more and more nearly free and then share it on redistribution networks on a collaborative commons. What we're finding now is that the labor costs are moving to a near zero marginal cost labor. And some of you read my book, The End of Work, 1995. We laid this all out, all the way up to the AI and the advanced analytics. As Paul knows, it was kind of controversial at the time. But I was generous of the Economist. They wrote a cover story at the time saying, well, I don't know. They were generous. In 2011, they came back with another cover story and said, well, we relooked at it. He got it right. I don't always get it right. None of us always get it right. Paul's been in the business of futures for years. But once in a while, we get it somewhere where it is. In case of work, we've got workerless factories. We got virtual retailing. We are automating white-collar and service front and back office functions. And now we're going after the knowledge workers with analytics and algorithms, and we don't need all the lawyers. We don't need the accountants. We don't need all the radiologists because we can use analytics to help us through the process. So as the private marketplace becomes more automated with AI and analytics and robotics and technology displacement, how do people define their useful life? It comes to a big question mark because we're so enamored with the idea, we're so embedded with this concept that the only way a person can judge their value in life is by being attendant to machines and producing widgets and services, and their value is how much productivity they can get out and then accrue some wealth. That is the way we define the value of a human being on this planet. How narrow a description. The millennial generation is beginning to see another option. This has happened since the Great Recession. A survey was done last year of 9,000 honor students in high school, and they asked, what kind of employment do you want? These are kids that lived through the Great Recession. And they said, we want meaningful employment, not just the dollar. These are the kids that are on the collaborative commons. And when they asked them, they listed 200 enterprises that these honor students could work for. They didn't pick Google, and they didn't pick General Motors. You know what came out number one on the list of 200 enterprises that 9,000 students wanted to work for? St. Jude's Hospital. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? On the social commons. This is heartful and hopeful. Absolutely. What we're beginning to see is a mass migration of employment from the private enterprise marketplace to the social commons. The employment in the social commons has been increasing for the last 20 years, while employment in the private marketplace has been decreasing. And the reason is the social commons requires human engagement. It's creating social capital, arts, social, culture, helping each other, our fellow human beings, transcending ourselves. Machines can't do that. They never will. And that's why a whole younger generation coming through the universities are now defining themselves as social entrepreneurs. For my generation, that would be an oxymoron. You cannot be social and be entrepreneurial because it's caveat emptor, and it's each person pursues their own self-interest, as Adam Smith would say. And if you pursue your own self-interest and you don't even think about anyone else's interest, somehow you will benefit the common good. I always thought that was a strange dictum by Adam Smith, but so be it. The young social entrepreneurs now coming through the universities, they believe in being entrepreneurial. Prosumers have to be entrepreneurial. We have millions of people now as entrepreneurs. So, but their entrepreneurial spirit requires that they be embedded in deep social networks and that they benefit the value of the network and it benefits them. Completely different than Adam Smith's idea that each individual is an autonomous agent only pursuing their own self-interest. So we have a younger generation around the world, social entrepreneurs, partly in the profit-making community, partly in the nonprofit, and sometimes in a hybrid relationship. And they're the early, if you will, trailblazers of this new collaborative commons. Lastly, who's going to control this Internet of Things and this build-out? The central assumption of the Internet that made it a success is something called network neutrality. When Berners-Lee put out the World Wide Web in 1990, it was designed so that it would be network neutral, so that anybody with a service provider could go up on the web and nobody is discriminated against. You're not put at the back of the line. You're not put at the front of the line. Your information is treated on the same level as everybody else's once you're in the system. In January, our Supreme Court, and you can tell the vote, 5-4, it's always 5-4, struck down network neutrality. They're getting ready for the Internet of Things and the great conflict between investor capitalists and commoners on the collaborative commons. They struck it down. And they said to the Federal Communication Commission, network neutrality, your protocol, this was not part of your mandate. You went beyond your mandate. So now the Federal Communication Commission has to go back and rewrite their protocols in order to try to, once again, establish network neutrality. However, the telecom and cable companies, they are moving with a vengeance. And they now want, they're saying, we own the pipes. We put a lot of investment here, so we want to be able to prioritize. So if you want a little bit more access, you got to pay some premium. Or maybe we'll exclude some people because it doesn't fit in with our business relationships. And you know what? That data we're collecting, why shouldn't we get a little of that? So we can then give it to third parties and commodify and commercialize the pipes. And it's not just the telecom and cable companies. Let me say that we now have to be concerned about some of the great Internet companies that have actually helped provide this phenomenal new thing called the commons. I love Google. I Google every day. I don't know what I would do without the magic box. These young people that put this thing together, they're brilliant. Facebook, we love Facebook. We love Twitter. I buy a lot of my stuff on Amazon, not all of it. However, these Internet companies have become so big, so fast, we've got to ask some questions now. And we want to make sure we get the best of what they can provide us, and we need a collegial discussion with them, so we're working on the same page here, to use a metaphor. We're working on the same page here so we can facilitate a future for all of us and not regret this commons. Google has 6 billion queries a day. They control somewhere around 67, 68% of the research engine market in this country, maybe about 90% in Europe, $50 billion in revenue. Facebook, 1 out of 6 people on Facebook, $7 billion in revenue. And tweeting, 650 million people. Amazon, 1 out of every 3 people goes up on Amazon for a product purchase. They got 122 million customers. So what we are starting to see is these Internet companies, which have been so instrumental in helping nurture the early part of this Internet of Things, the communication Internet, they're starting to look like global social utilities. In other words, they're so essential to our life that they're almost like public goods, and that's their success. We couldn't do without them now. So the question is, what kind of a global authority do we need to put in place so that we can all work together and not at each other's expense? We need the 3 stakeholders at the table, government at every level, private enterprise at every level, and the civil society, social commons at every level. We have to figure out how to manage this global commons for everybody. Last thoughts. It isn't just about the technology. Many of you know, if you've read my books over the years, I am far from a techno-optimist. I've been pretty critical of a lot of technologies over the last 40 years. I simply believe that this Internet of Things, this collaborative commons, gives us an opportunity to democratize economic life so we're all players. And at near zero marginal cost, we heal the planet. Because what this does, at the faster we get to near zero marginal cost, the more efficient we become at using fewer resources and sharing it with more people. Fewer resources and sharing it with more people, whether it be cars or bikes or homes or whatever. And as we get to a renewable energy internet, we get off fossil fuels quickly. And the good thing is we can have near zero marginal cost energy that's almost free and address climate change. And with automated transport and logistics, we can lower the marginal cost of the resources we use on Earth. So near zero marginal cost is actually tautological with sustainability. Because someone asked me this morning on Michael Krasny's show, they called in, they said, wait a minute, if you're going to have everything available, abundant, doesn't that mean everyone's going to use up the resources quicker? No. The reason we use up the resources so quickly is because we have a world where we think everything is scarce and we're frightened to death that tomorrow may be a rainy day. So we hoard, we consume, we inflate our possessions so that we can be a bulwark against a bad day and everyone else who wants to get the goodies. And that's how we determine status in society. Those who have, those who have not. In a world where everything's relative, not everything, but most things are relatively free and abundant, we wouldn't have the desperate climb to hoard, and we wouldn't see any particular status in doing it, because everyone's on an even playing field. So I have some guarded hope on it, but I would say this. We need a change in consciousness to go with this technology platform. We need a new narrative. We need to shift from geopolitics to biosphere consciousness in one generation. The biosphere is the sheath from the stratosphere to the depths of the oceans, 40 miles, where all living things, all living beings, excuse me, interact with all chemicals to create a very complex choreography that we call life on Earth. That's the biosphere. It's our indivisible community. Here's why I'm guardedly hopeful. We have young kids coming home from all over the world, 14, 15-year-old kids with biosphere consciousness. And that is, they're saying to their parents, they're saying to their dad, why are you using so much water while you shave? That's wasting the water. You're going to hear a lot of that in California. Forget the lawn, the shaving. You got a lot of kids coming home saying, why is the TV on in that room? No one's there. And why are we got two cars? Why don't we car share one? And here's the one I'm really fond of. My wife and I are very heavily engaged in animal protection, animal rights issues, which I think is a cutting edge for all of us. We got kids coming home saying, I'm not eating that hamburger. Sorry, Mom and Dad. Where'd that hamburger come from? Did it come from a rainforest in Central America? Did they have to knock off the trees for 4 inches of topsoil to graze the cow? And the kids are smart enough to know that those trees are a canopy for rare animals and plants that only live there. Trees go, extinction. And then the kids are connecting and they say, well, trees are a sink to absorb CO2 from industrial climate change. No trees, the temperature rises on the planet. The temperature rises on the planet, it throws off the water cycle of the earth. We get more floods, more droughts, and some man or woman with their farm, they can't feed their kids because of the burger on the plate. These kids are learning ecological footprint. It's a metric. We can measure it. They're learning that everything we do all day long intimately impacts the well-being of some other family and some other of our fellow creatures. And by the way, they have a right to be here with us or without us. They're the ultimate victims. And they're learning that our indivisible community is the biosphere we live in. This is good news. So here's where I end up. I'm guardedly hopeful. I don't know. I may be the oldest guy in the room, person in the room here. But I have to say, I won't be here to see it, so you'll have to send me a postcard. But I'm guardedly hopeful, but I'm not sure. I really do believe that this shift to an Internet of Things, a distributed, collaborative, laterally scaled world where we can bring the human race together and connect us so we start to think as a human family, think of our fellow creatures as part of the family, and the Skyping and the global classrooms and the connectivity will make us feel like we're one planet. I'm guardedly hopeful we can get there, but there are so many things that could derail this, and we're running against the clock on climate change. So the question is, can we have the commitment and the motivation and the passion over three generations to stay the course, get rid of all the peripheral concerns, make the transition to an Internet of Things platform, establish a collaborative commons alongside the capitalist system, and begin to create a zero marginal cost society that allow us to use the planet's resources more efficiently, and hopefully we heal the Earth. Hopefully in time for our children and grandchildren, our fellow creatures, to live in a planet that's flourishing again. Thank you.
That was tremendous, Jeremy. Have a seat. And, oh, more questions. So we've actually already just called the airline and put you on a later flight.
There is no later flight.
Because, we thought we could see if Larry or Sergey had loaned you a chat.
We have plenty of time. We're not in a hurry.
So what I've done, I have read Jeremy's book, and I really recommend you all take a look at it. And what I've done with the questions is I've done a sort to focus on things that are not explicitly and thoroughly answered in the book. So if your question doesn't get answered, buy the book. Just a reminder for the radio audience before we start, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to economist Jerry Rifkin, author of the new book, The Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. I'm Paul Saffo, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see videos of the programs online on the club's YouTube channel. And, of course, Commonwealth is at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, and on Twitter, and has a bright future in the Collaborative Commons.
And just a correction, it's zero marginal cost society.
Zero. Did I say? Yeah. I'll get this right eventually.
Remember that zero.
Maybe after I read the book the second time. So let's start.
My family never reads any of my books, so I'm always glad when people do. You know, it's always refreshing. Yeah.
So there are a couple of questions around inequality. Yeah. And your book comes out at a moment in time where wealth inequality continues to diverge. Do you see that tide reversing?
I spend a considerable amount of time in the first part of the book on a history of how we move from a feudal economy to a nascent market economy and then to a capitalist economy. And the reason I did that is that, remember I said every economy has a form of communication, a form of power, and a form of mobility. And if you know what those three things are, you can pretty well know how they organize economic life and how it's distributed. In the first and second industrial revolution, Paul, as you know, we had centralized energies. They were very costly to get from underground to the end user, so we had to put together lots of capital. That's why we created investment capital, shareholding companies, to get that energy to us. Then we had to have centralized telecommunications, very costly. It required lots of capital. We had to set up investor capital companies to finance it. And because of the capital requirements, we had to organize this system in what we called vertically integrated companies to create economies of scale. So the idea was, if you're embedded in this system and you're a company taking advantage of this operating platform, you better be under one roof, so that all your suppliers and your downstream distributors are all under one company's roof. Therefore, you eliminate the middlemen, and you can keep your margins up and put out cheaper products, all right? So, of course, the downside of that is some companies became so successful, they monopolized the market, then didn't let new innovations come in, and for a time they thwarted the marginal cost being reduced, but eventually they were broken. But what I'm suggesting here is that this system was the best system we knew how to create to manage regimes based on first steam power printing, the telegraph, the locomotive, and steam power coal, and then electricity, the telephone, oil, and the internal combustion engine. While those on top disproportionately benefited, it's also fair to say that putting out mass cheap products and hiring a lot of people to make them, we all were better off. Those cocooned in the industrial system. Those on the margins that we exploited in other countries for their raw resources, they never had the advantage of this, and they are the untold story. But in the system, we all did better off and are much better off now than we were 300 years ago. But at the end of the line, we have 500 companies now, Fortune 500. Their revenue equals one-third of the GDP of the world. That really takes your breath away. The Internet of Things, because of the nature of the communication power and mobility, is designed to be flat, lateral, distributed, and allow millions of us to come together in not vertically integrated networks, but laterally integrated networks, where the economies of scale allow millions of small players to come together and create much more potential productivity than you would under vertically integrated companies. So it's a different model completely. This is what the utility companies found out in Germany in 5 years. This is what the recording companies found out here in 5 years, the newspapers, et cetera. So it's a new model. And think about, if you have direct engagement with each other without any middlemen, you're eliminating all of those transaction costs that are marked up, and you can send your margins down, down, down to the point where you're creating a much more democratically managed economy. It's not utopia. It's just the next possible part of the human journey that makes a little bit more sane and justifiable world.
Because I think in the history of economics, each new abundance inevitably creates a new scarcity. Where are the scarcities lurking in this future?
I suspect, in the short run, attention span.
Is that my phone?
You know, where Paul and I were just talking about the universities and, you know, each generation. What's interesting about the communication internet is every communication revolution in history that merged with energy revolutions, the communication revolutions at each time increased the metaphors we could store to express ourselves. Oral language, you had formulaic responses. So if I'm feeling really bad, someone will give me some formulaic little quote, which won't really get to my real being. When we went to the print revolution and novels, we could create more words, more metaphors, and we could actually express ourselves and know the other empathically as ourselves because we could customize it to each individual. The problem when you get to TV and then the internet is there's much more ability to communicate, but our ability to maintain and build on language is now diminishing because of the attention span. So what we now have is our college graduates in the U.S., you know this, Paul, the National Endowment did a study, and reading comprehension and writing ability has gone down by one-third among college graduates. So that's because all the words are up there on the Internet, but they're using less rare words per thousand than they did when they were reading magazines or books. Because the attention span, you have so much information flowing in and out of the system. We need to find a way to use the system for our purposes, not against. And I'll leave you with just a quick anecdote. Henry David Thoreau, and by the way, it wasn't so rough for him. On the weekends, he went home and his mother did his laundry. I wanted you to know that.
We had dinner at the Emerson's.
Yeah, that's right. But when the telegraph came in, this is a great one-liner. Henry David Thoreau said, now we have the telegraph so Maine can talk to Texas. The question is, does Maine have anything to say to Texas? So with the Internet, we have to try to find a way to take this amazing communication medium that's connecting the human race and allow it to enrich our metaphors, our ability to empathize, and to establish a sense of connectivity to each other. That's a big drawing card.
So I want to explore this jobs thing a little more. It's a subject you've written on many times. And as I was reading through your book, because it only came out a week ago, I noted something very interesting that's happening in Switzerland this week that ties back to things you've thought about, and that's the notion of the universal basic income. And so for the audience, Switzerland actually has a referendum. It's going to get voted down, but it's going to open the conversation to give every Swiss citizen a guaranteed income of $33,000 a year, whether they work or not. And I put this in the context of, you know, the Easterland paradox. For the audience, the Easterland paradox was noted that between 1974 and 2004, U.S. average income doubled, but our average level of happiness did not. And there have been various different studies, and I thought the Swiss picked 33,000, and as you know, because you've written about it, there is what's called the bliss point.
Mm-hmm.
And that somewhere between $30,000 and $33,000 mm-hmm. is the optimum amount. If you below that, if you have less than that, your happiness increases in direct proportion up to mm-hmm. about $30,000, $33,000. And above that, your happiness still increases, but not so fast. And the satiation point is $70,000.
Yeah.
Above that, it doesn't matter, so it's just not worth having that money. What do you think? I mean, in this, when I think of Keynes, and he spoke of the good life, and that was what his generation of economists was seeking, what does the good life look in the age of the collaborative commons, and is it a world in which universal basic income is something countries actually do?
I recommended a guaranteed income in the end of work. Milton Friedman did it before I did. When technology displaces employment, there's two things you can do. reduce the workforce or reduce the work week. For most of the history of the labor movement, the trade unions were always in support of reducing the work week because the idea was to have leisure and not just to have money.
Just, I don't think the audience knows it, but you're more or less directly responsible for the 32-hour work week in France, complete with
I'm surprised you knew that.
The Sûreté coming in, sneaking into CEOs' offices who were working late and very publicly arresting them to enforce the 38-hour rule.
Can you do that for us?
Would you stop?
Well, I'll tell you a funny anecdote about that. So the book was put out in France, The End of Work, and Michel Rocard, an old friend of mine, wrote the foreword to it. And the only reason that people read the book is because he wrote the foreword. And then we went ahead and we introduced the 30-hour work week in France. It's been a fairly decent success because employers like it, as you know, because it's more flexibility in terms of labor. You know, Keynes, you mentioned Keynes, he wrote a little essay in 1930. Yeah. Everyone ignored it. It was the Depression was going. People were depressed because of the Depression. He wrote a little essay saying, "A Letter to My Grandchildren." He said, "You're going to hear more and more about something called technology displacement. It's a new term. Many people are frightened of it. Where are the jobs going to go?" But he said this could be the liberation for the human race. Because as we move further into the 20th century and the 21st century, the technologies can do the heavy lifting. It can liberate the human race so that we can get on with the more important business of life, our transcendence, our sense of mission, our journey here on this planet. Let the machines do all the work. And he said, it may be in my grandchildren's generation, we will reach that point. It may be his most poignant forecast, actually. I think that our kids, here's my bet.
I got one better on Keynes than that one.
What's
finish
that?
Your thought, because then I'm going to ask you a question.
I suspect all of what I'm saying could be derailed. Really, I mean, history is mercurial, cataclysmic events, poor leaderships, the wrong road taken, climate change, cyber terrorism. The human journey is fraught with obstacles. But if we can move toward this journey and even get half of what I'm talking about by 2050, I suspect our grandchildren will look back on the 20th century where millions of people's whole life was dedicated to making widgets and accumulating a certain amount of material possessions, and they'll think, what a terrible way to value human life. They'll be as repugnant thinking about how people's life was wasted as we were when we look at slavery and serfdom, because they'll say, there's more meaningful things to do in life. Let the machines do all of the menial work so we can get on with using this wonderful social brain in our empathic circuitry to try to reintegrate into this beautiful planet we live in. It's a nice journey to set our vision toward, even if we only get halfway there.
So, you know, this is where I have a bone to pick with our predecessors, because I'm always reminded that Daniel Bell in the 1960s, he forecast that robots would take our jobs away by 1980, and he said the great social challenge would be trying to figure out what to do with all our spare time, forecasting the leisure society, which I can't wait. But going back to Keynes, and there was one subject in your book you touched on, but you didn't go as deeply as I would like, and that is, where does religion fit here? And I think of Keynes, you know, in the 20s, and Keynes famously was neither a Christian nor a socialist. But he was what he called a reverse secularist.
Yeah.
And he argued at the time, everybody said technology would drive religion out and prosperity would, you know, the corporate headquarters, the capital had replaced the cathedral. And he said, actually, no, it's the opposite, that he believed that religious attitudes and beliefs would become more necessary, essential, as society approached that abundance. And here we are at a moment in time where the old religions, some old religions are on the ropes, others are rising. I also think of Nietzsche's famous quip, nearly 2,000 years and no new God. Do we get a new religious efflorescence out of this, or must we have that?
The Zero Marginal Cost Society is a third book in a three-book series. It started with The Empathic Civilization. The second book was The Third Industrial Revolution. The third is The Zero Marginal Cost Society. The reason I say that is The Empathic Civilization, I warn you, it's 660 pages. But I was trying to rethink the human narrative, the human journey. What are we all about? Historians paint a pretty bad picture because they only look at all of the great unstabilizing events, genocides, wars, social upheaval. If you see history as a series of these one-off events, you get a pretty bad picture of the human race.
But just one damn thing after another.
Yeah, it is, exactly. Well, Hegel, I remember reading George Friedrich Hegel. He had a comment I read 35 years ago. It stuck with me. He said, happiness are the blank pages of history. They're the pages of harmony. So when we look back at history, what I at least found in my look at it is that all through history, human beings come together and they create communication revolutions to manage energy regimes, which allow us to bring more people together in bigger social units. The energy, the communication allows us to broaden our temporal spatial footprint. All forager hunter societies, their communication was oral, their energy was their human body, and their ability to empathize, which we now believe is the most basic core to our circuitry, our ability to empathize with the other, it extended to blood ties, because that was the level of their society's limits. If you were in the next valley, you were a demon, not a human. If you go to the great hydraulic civilizations in Sumer, India, and China, the new communication energy, centralized agriculture, and the canal systems, they went from mythological consciousness to theological consciousness. All the great religions were formed then. I'm Jewish. The Abrahamic religion, Buddhism in India, and secular spiritualism with Confucius in China. And they all created writing to manage it, these centralized systems. And when we went to theological consciousness, empathy extended from blood ties to religious affiliations. In first century Rome, all Christians that converted kissed each other and said brother and sister because they were part of a fictional family. And the fictional family was big enough so they could empathize across these new communication energy civilizations. Let's skip to the 19th century. First industrial revolution with communication energy matrix. We now are able to manage systems across entire continents. We create nations. And now all of a sudden we move from theological consciousness to ideological consciousness, and national identity becomes your new family. It's a bigger unit. So now all French people, I mean, there were 200 languages there in the 12th century. They all think they're French. And now they're all brothers and sisters and kissing each other because they can empathize in a broader temporal spatial format because of the energy and communication. The Germans, well, they don't kiss. The Germans will all shake hands with each other, but they won't shake hands with the Italians. Again, is a shift in empathy and evolves to a more sophisticated cosmopolitanism. In the 20th century, we shift to psychological consciousness. And we start to empathize with people of like-minded affinities and associations. So here's what I think from a religious point of view. My sense is we've gone from mythological to theological to ideological and psychological consciousness and extended empathy from blood ties to religious affiliation to national identities. We have been good at expanding our empathy. And now with biosphere becoming our individual community, and this Internet of Things allowing us to connect in one neural system, all of us and our fellow creatures, we could begin to see the biosphere as our community and begin to empathize with our human family and our fellow creatures as part of that family. It's a possibility. There are dark periods in between, as you know, Paul, where everything breaks down. This is not utopia. And it's the opposite of utopia. In utopia, there's no empathy. In heaven, I can tell you if you're going to go to heaven, there's no empathy. And there's no empathy in utopias because everything's perfect. There's no suffering. There's no mortality. Empathy is kind of, if I empathize with you, I'm feeling your death and I'm celebrating your life at the same time. I know that your life is as fragile as mine, that life's precarious, you never know what's going to happen, and so I'm rooting for you. If I show my compassion, I want you to thrive, whether it's you or a fox in the woods. So to empathize is to realize we live in an imperfect world. It's pretty damn precarious. And we simply are celebrating each other's fragile ability to flourish on this planet, humans and other creatures. I like living in an empathetic society. I think that's really the core of spiritualism that's evolving over history. But, that's one person's read on it.
I have a story for you. I also have a question that you're going to answer after for a young lady who is an entrepreneur at TaskRabbit, because you owe her some career advice, but we run out of time. As you were talking, and as I was reading your book, and I was thinking about the collaborative commons, I was reminded of that old story, the pious man who goes to heaven. St. Peter looks at him and said, you've lived a very good life. And he was a software engineer, so he said, you get a choice. You can go to heaven or you can go to hell. And you can go visit both. check them out. He said, sure, why not? So he went down to hell, and it was nothing like he expected. It was a vast banquet, and amidst the vast banquet, everybody was starving because the utensils, the knives and the forks, were each 6 feet long, and when they picked them up, they couldn't put them to their mouth. When he went to heaven, he discovered heaven was exactly the same, except in heaven, people fed each other. And as I read your book, I had this hopeful sense that perhaps in this century, in the Creative Commons, we will all learn in our abundance to feed each other.
Very well said. It's a nice vision to hold on to. Absolutely.
Good.
Hopefully we can get there.
So join me in thanking Jeremy for speaking to us. And as I of course mentioned, Jeremy is the author of the new book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. We also want to thank you, our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Paul Saffo, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thanks, Paul. That was a lot of fun.